I'm Alan McClellan. I'm here with Aislinn Noski. And Aislinn, what got you into early music to start with?
Well, I started playing the violin when I was 3 and a half, and I went to the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto, in Canada, to do an undergraduate degree in modern violin performance. And while I was there in school, I was actually very passionate about chamber music. I had a very serious string quartet with some friends of mine, and I always imagined that I would go on and be a string quartet player professionally. That was my dream, and that is what we all had the intention of doing, and until things didn't work out, as they tend to do when you're that young. I was about 19, and we decided we needed to part ways to pursue other musical activities. And while I was sitting around, to be honest, feeling a little sorry for myself, and a good friend of mine said, "Hey, you need to stop moping around. I have a concert this Friday. I need you. It's on Baroque violin. It's going to be great. You're going to love it." I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never played on gut strings. How do you work this thing?" She said, "No time. Just take it home and practice it. Just play." And that concert was actually with a group I'm still in called I Furiosi Baroque Ensemble. And I remember it was a little nerve-wracking for sure for the first time, but we had a lot of fun. And from then on, I was really bitten by the bug of early music to figure out what exactly the differences are between the modern violin and the Baroque violin. And the exploration of historical context really just made me interested in the academic side of working on classical music in a way that I hadn't been until that point.
You hadn't really been interested in history per se before, and this suddenly got fascinating because you were actually doing it. Is that?
Yeah, I wasn't disinterested, but I think my interest ended at the end of the class where the material was being presented to me, and it would often end at the moment that I finished studying a work by a certain composer who I needed to learn about. And I was interested, but not driven and passionate about finding out more. And the attitude in early music that I've encountered is one of exploration and one of trying to always discover new things and put the music in as much of a rich context as we can historically. And I found that really exciting.
Would you say that's what keeps you doing it? I mean, these days, or there's probably more too, I get.
Well, that's what got me started doing it. I think, well, I would be playing music whether anyone was listening or not, because I can't stop myself. But I do know that attitude of exploration is probably what keeps me feeling like the music that I perform is very fresh. I feel as though, even though I play music that's a couple of hundred years old, to me it's always new music, and that means that every day is a new artistic experience, and I find that incredibly exciting.
What's it like to step out of the section and become the leader or the concertmaster, or were those always kind of roles that you were comfortable with?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've never thought that I would need to be, or that I needed to end up being, a concertmaster or any kind of leader. I, by lucky chance, fell into the amazing opportunity of being a member of an orchestra in Canada called Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra, which was led for 30 years by Jean Lamont, one of the violinists. And she was a fantastic leader, very inspirational in many ways. And one of the ways that really, I think, influenced me was to see that while she was definitely the leader and she was definitely in charge, she insisted and actually demanded of everybody that they be as completely personally invested in the artistic process as possible. It was definitely her final choice in artistic matters, but it was as close to a musical democracy as one that I've been able to see so far in my career. And so it never occurred to me that a chamber orchestra wouldn't act like that if it could. And so I do enjoy leading, and I also really enjoy playing in the section. When there's a strong vision artistically happening, I can get on board with about anything. So the roles are both of playing a supporting role and playing a leadership role are both very exciting and rewarding in different ways, and I enjoy doing both.
So you don't feel like you've got to be in control of the vision all the time?
No, in fact, I think that I don't want to be in control. Even when I'm leading a concert, I don't seek to be in control of the artistic product. If I have to make decisions just because someone has to, that's fine. But I would actually prefer, when I work with a group, I always think that I'm trying to bring the best results for that I can get out of everybody together in the moment. And it's always different. So to me, projecting my artistic vision on other people isn't as exciting as trying to find an artistic vision together as a team, because we do become more than the sum of our parts. My ideas are okay, but most of my colleagues' ideas are fantastic.
Yeah, I sing in a chorus, and one of the things the conductor says a lot is take charge, you know, take control of the vision. So because there's 40 people here, but we still need to do that.
Yeah, so. I completely agree with that philosophy. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than watching a machine of however many people, 17, 30, 40 people on stage who are completely committed in their own personal way to the art that's happening. You hear that, and I think you feel it in the experience.
Absolutely. So Vivaldi was a violinist. Did he treat the violin differently than other instruments or in the orchestra? I mean, did he, when he wrote a violin concerto, I mean, he wrote concertos for all different instruments, mm-hmm. but was he particularly zeroing in on things about the violin?
Well, his violin writing is... I've only played as a violinist in the orchestra for the bassoon concertos and the cello concertos and all the other wonderful concertos. So I can't speak thoroughly to what it's like to solo on bassoon, but my friends tell me that those are wickedly difficult pieces and that they're very well written for the instrument. In fact, every instrumentalist I've ever spoken to says he writes well for their instrument. So that speaks to a certain kind of compositional knowledge, I think, that he had. I have to think that he wrote music that he probably would have enjoyed playing himself for the violin, because we know he was a fabulous violinist. And so one of the things I like about Vivaldi is that he knows how to be very flashy on the instrument as well as very lyrical. And with Vivaldi, I like to say to my students who are learning the concertos, you know, with Vivaldi, sometimes it sounds actually even harder than it is. So it's like he's trying to make us all look good on stage. And it's a wonderful favor that he's done us that way. I'd say other composers of that time, that's not always the case. Sometimes it's actually much harder to execute than it sounds. But I think Vivaldi must have been quite a charming guy with a lot of grace, and he knew how to make it sound really difficult.
And Locatelli is something different. He was a virtuoso as well, but would you put him in the category of making it sound hard, or?
Actually, he's one of the people I was referring to, that actually with Locatelli, I think it's often a lot harder than it even seems. And through researching for this concert, I found out a few interesting things about Locatelli. He was hugely influential as a teacher and with the music that he published. But actually, there's not a lot of records of him performing very frequently. And there's actually some theories out there that maybe there's actually a letter that exists, someone speaking about Locatelli, a contemporary, and this person says, well, we all know that Locatelli refuses to play in public, but will only play in rooms with amateur players. So I wonder if there's some aspect of him being shy, perhaps just really not liking to perform because of nervousness, or maybe writing incredibly difficult music that he may not have wanted to play in public. I don't know. I just can't help but think that he should have been out there playing it because it was selling like hotcakes. I don't know. I mean, someday I might have a lot to answer for with that, but I'm just curious. Someone like Vivaldi, it's been well documented how well he played. But with Locatelli, maybe he was just a shy guy. It's very beautiful music in any case. But I just find it interesting that his compositions were so influential to future generations of violinists, but we don't really have much record of him playing them himself.
There's not that much history of his life in general, right? But I understand, one of the things that caught my eye when I read about him just briefly for this was that he left behind a huge library of stuff.
Yeah.
He was interested in all kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I find that very interesting as well. In fact, there's a piece that we perform on this concert called the Pianto that he wrote based on the myth of Arianna, Pianto d'Arianna. And I have this theory that he probably in his library had a copy of the Monteverdi Arianna scene that was published. And I actually have been called out by that because there's no evidence. People have questioned me on that. And I can't put the book in his hand, but he was very learned and well-read by all accounts. And so that Monteverdi piece was very influential at the time. I suspect he at least knew of it, even if he didn't own one, but interesting to think about in either case.
Yeah, for that great lost opera of Monteverdi's, an incredible kind of mystery in music. Mm-hmm. he must have, his imagination must have been captured. I agree.
Sure, I guess the myth, the Arianna myth, was not only represented by Monteverdi, but that was the Monteverdi piece was very influential at the time. So I wonder, we'll never know. Or maybe someone can itemize the contents of his library for me someday. That would be interesting.
And this myth was Can you describe the myth, or is that asking too much? Because I'm hazy on it. It's Ariadne, right? Mm-hmm. Being left on the island.
Yeah. Well, there's different versions of the myth, and from what I could tell, the one that I think Locatelli was thinking of, because it suits the narrative that I've attached to this piece in my head, is that Ariadne gets taken to an island off a desolate island off the Greek coast by Theseus. And it's all going smashingly because it's very romantic. And then he takes off. He has second thoughts for whatever reason. And so at first, I think she thinks he's coming back. And then actually, she sees the ship actually going away, not coming closer. And so then she, you know, goes from weeping to what I like to think of as musical ugly crying. And the music gets very intense. And there's a lot of wailing, which I think Locatelli represents with some sobbing motifs on the violin. And then in this version of the myth, I believe, Bacchus comes and says, "Hey, it's okay, don't be so sad. Lucky you, I can see you're very distressed, so I'm going to take you as my consort." Isn't that great? Well, I'm not so sure she agrees with him in how great that is. Because, of course, Locatelli's version ends on a very sad note. And one version of the myth is that after Bacchus takes her as a consort, she is instilled in heaven as celestial pearls, a necklace that represents tears, or I can't quite remember the end of it. There's many different versions, but that is a simplification, to be sure. But that does actually, to me, line up with what I think Locatelli's trying to do dramatically in his piece.
It might not have been her idea of the perfect outcome of that story.
Or maybe it was. I don't know.
I mean, the chance to be a god is something.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you just kind of about the difference that you feel. We talked a bit about this, the difference between Locatelli and Vivaldi, different school. There's this, Locatelli was sent off to study with Corelli at first, but they say he became more like Vivaldi later in his career. But
I think with Locatelli, I think it is said that he studied with Corelli, but there's not evidence. There's not actual evidence that I've been able to find. It's interesting to know whether he did or not. And I guess the styles of Vivaldi and Locatelli differ in that, there's sheer volume. I mean, Vivaldi beats almost anyone in terms of how much he churned out, 400 plus concertos for violin alone. Locatelli's a much smaller output, but what Locatelli did, I think, is really almost specialized himself in exploiting and showing people what virtuosity in the high register of the violin could be. Vivaldi will exploit the whole violin, and yes, you'll often hear fast high passages in Vivaldi, but with Locatelli, he just takes that technical idea of playing really high and really fast up to the next peak of extreme difficulty, and his violin, the caprices for solo violin are just, even by today's technical standards and with modern equipment meant to ease playing high on the violin, it's actually still really, really hard to play that music. So
this program has two things from L'estro Armonico. What's L'estro Armonico?
Now, that was Vivaldi's Opus 3, and it was such a smash bestseller in the 18th century that it was, I almost think of it as the Da Vinci Code of its day. I mean, publishers, they could not keep it on the shelves. And one of the things that's interesting about Vivaldi's Opus 3 to me is that he chose to have it published in Amsterdam rather than anywhere in Italy. And in Amsterdam at that time, their printing techniques were much more sophisticated than anywhere in Europe. And it was known for that. But it must have cost Vivaldi a lot of money at a time in his life when he probably didn't have that much. It cost him extra to have it sent to Amsterdam, but because he spent that money, he got a much more legible and beautiful to look at piece published. And I think that went a long way to having it become very popular and circulate widely. It's almost like I wonder if he just knew that when he hit his Opus 3, he had something special. Because he did, each concerto, there's a dozen concertos, and each one of them is an absolute gem. And the Four Seasons comes later. It's in his Opus 8. But Opus 3 really made Vivaldi a sensation, as much as one could be a household sensation in terms of 18th century music publishing.
And then there's the cello concerto. And
yeah, Guy Fishman is our principal cellist, and he is our featured soloist in the Vivaldi cello concerto. I wish he was here to say more about the concerto, because I actually am not sure when that was written. My understanding is that Vivaldi wrote cello concertos throughout his life, and some of them are from earlier and some of them are from later. I chose this one to contrast the mood of the pieces around it. I really wanted to have a different kind of a virtuosity and a different kind of a sound color to contrast all the high violin music going on around it.
Is there like, and now that you talk about the, you know, the sequence of things, was there kind of an arc that you were thinking of through this whole program?
Well, there's not so much a narrative arc. It does build to the emotional climax of the final Locatelli Pianto d'Arianna. It's more that I wanted to feature the different textures possible with a string orchestra of the size and forces of the 18th century. One common thread throughout the program is that almost every single piece has two independent viola lines, as opposed to the much more common one. Usually it's two violins, one viola, and then cello and basso continuo. And the five-part texture of adding that second viola part is actually a little bit unusual in Italian music. That was much more popular in French music. And that's actually a really main feature of French music. So I came across a few pieces in the Italian style that had this second viola part. And when I was performing them in different groups, I was struck by how much more richness was added by that extra layer of it's like adding another delicious layer inside the sandwich. You know, it can really just take it from an ordinary to an extraordinary. You put that really fancy cheese in there and it's just dynamite. And so I wanted to, we have more violas than usual playing with us. Normally I would have two violists in this program, type of program, and we have four, two in first viola and two in second. And so I hear a real richness to the tapestry of the sound. So that was part of why I chose the specific concertos I did that would lead up to this final one with Locatelli, where all the parts, including the two viola parts, are very involved.
Well, if you were a violinist in the 18th century, would you be Vivaldi or Locatelli?
I would be Haydn. No, that's a really good question. I would like to meet Vivaldi very much. I just have a few questions. Locatelli, I have different questions about, but I have really pressing questions for Vivaldi.
I want to know
some of his fingerings, and I want to know. I would want to hear him play some of his concertos for me to say, could you show me what you meant here? I'm just curious. You know, I think he was probably a fantastic player.
I know contemporary music has such an advantage, doesn't it? When you're able to actually converse with the composer and find out what they meant.
I recently did commission a Canadian composer named Michael Osterley to write a piece for me for an orchestra I was playing with. And I kept forgetting that I was able to ask him questions. It was so out of my habit that I would, you know, tear my hair out for days wondering what he meant when he wrote such and such. And I should just ask him. He's on Messenger right now. Okay. And he always had wonderful answers. Yeah.
That's great. So you're doing lots of contemporary music as well as early music, or is it majority of early Baroque stuff like that?
These days it's actually a majority of Baroque music, but I have a real passion for new music too. I'll play anything on a violin, don't get me wrong, but I love new music as well as old music. And so it's just that I'm running out of hours in the day rather than a lack of interest in doing a lot of playing. But I used to, you know, for many years I was lucky enough to play as an extra in the Toronto Symphony Orchestra when they were doing big projects, and I would get to play some really fantastic new things that way. And it's something I really enjoy, actually, commissioning new music.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you about the program.